Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On this episode, Redefine's executive editor Matt Ladner talks with Clint Bullock, a longtime education choice advocate, former co-founder of the Institute for Justice, and current associate justice on the Arizona Supreme Court. The two discuss his new co-authored book, Unshackled, Freeing America's K-12 Education System. The book is a thought experiment. How would we structure a 21st century K-12 school system starting from scratch with all of the technological resources available in the modern world? That question and more on this episode of Podcast Ed. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
Hello, this is Matthew Ladner, and I am the executive editor of Redefined. And today, the Redefined podcast, it is very much our pleasure to have Clint Bullock, a longtime veteran of the school choice movement, as our guest. Clint, of course, was the co-founder, I believe, of the Institute for Justice, was the victor of at least two United States Supreme Court cases I can think of. The first president of the Alliance for School Choice, a friend and colleague of long standing, and today is an associate justice on the Arizona Supreme Court and a research fellow in the Hoover Institute. So thanks very much for being here, Clint.
Matt, it is terrific to be with you.
Great. And we are here today to talk mostly about your new book called Unshackled by Clint Bullock and KJ Hardiman. Give us the elevator pitch for this new book.
Well, we begin with a thought experiment, which is what would our American K-12 education system look like today if we were starting from scratch with no preconceptions and with all of the amazing technological tools that we have available to us today. And that's a thought experiment we hope everyone who reads the book and others as well will engage in. And I don't think anyone who does that thought experiment will come up with a system that looks much like our current system, which is, of course, a 19th century system of education. So what we do in the book is to articulate some basic common sense principles that would guide the creation of a K-12 system that would be a 21st century system, and then draw out from those principles some of the changes that would be necessary to facilitate that 21st century model.
Yeah. So while you were talking, it just occurred to me that, you know, I used to watch book notes on C-SPAN, and now through technological changes, here we are doing our own little version, right? Which would not have been available to us in the past.
It's a great show. But now we can all do book notes.
And one of the chapters in the book, you have a, you know, pretty thorough critique of the status quo of K-12. If you had to summarize that critique, what would you say? Like, what's wrong with the school system we have now, Clint?
Well, you know, when you ask most people, do we have a good school system overall or a pretty mediocre one? Most of them say it's pretty mediocre. Then you ask those same people, is your school is your neighborhood school good or poor? They'll say our school is good. And the fact is that most public schools are not anywhere close to where they need to be in the 21st century for America to continue its dominance of the economy, or even continue to be a prosperous economy. You know, I would list, would you want your kids to learn math in Vietnam, Slovakia, or Poland? Most people would answer that question, no, of course not. And yet all three of those countries, along with 27 other OECD countries, that's the industrialized countries that we compete with, have better math systems than we do. When we're looking up at Slovakia, which most Americans wouldn't be able to find on a map, we're in serious trouble. And of course, the trouble is far greater for low-income and minority school children who have always been shafted by the system. And the academic gap between middle and upper-income kids and lower-income kids is getting wider. And certainly the pandemic has magnified that even more.
Right. What would you say, there are defenders of the current system who sometimes say that the real problem is poverty. You know, we have these poverty, and we won't cure our education problems until we cure poverty. What do you have to say about that?
Well, we're going to have a long time to wait, right? If our education system is working well, then all of our boats are going to rise. We don't really have control over many of the conditions of poverty, but we do have control over education and the opportunities that kids have. You take a low-income kid going to public school in Los Angeles or Chicago, certainly the odds are against that child going on to higher education or a productive livelihood. You take that same child and put that child in a KIPP academy, a charter school, or a success academy, and that child is going to thrive. So we have the means to do this. We know how to do it. But the current system simply doesn't allow the flexibility, the choices for either children to access effective schools or effective educational models, or for the public schools to repeat the name of the book, unshackle themselves and be able to respond to the needs of the kids.
The international testing data you referenced, for instance, you know, it shows that you know, American Anglo kids score pretty decently compared to European and Asian countries, but Black and Hispanic students closer to the average score in Mexico than the average score in, say, Slovenia or, you know, Germany or something like that. So obviously, and you guys talk about this in the book, there's a gigantic equity problem staring us in the face too.
That's absolutely right. And it's, you know, we hasten to add, it's not one that is solved by putting money into more money into the system. You know, we've experimented with that in places like my home state of New Jersey, where we're spending well beyond $20,000 per kid annually, the cost of an elite private school education. We are hardly getting elite results for those expenditures. And we spend more than almost any other country in the entire world, and we're just not getting the results that we need. One statistic that really blew me away that we report in the book is that in our biggest competitor, China, the 10% of the poorest kids in Shanghai outscore in math the top 10% of the kids in the United States. If that continues to be the case, they are going to absolutely clean our clocks. And it's not just a matter of equity or opportunity. It's a matter of survival and competition for us to get this right.
You know, one critique of, say, the charter and even the private choice movements in the past has been that it's sort of recreating stuff that has already been done, right? The critique would say, you know, if you go into a charter school, the kids are still lined up in rows of desks. There's still a teacher in the front. I personally don't agree with this critique because charter schools not only get better academic results, they do so at a more modest cost, right? So the big bang for the buck. But you and Kate spend some time in the book talking about innovative school models. Tell us, give us sort of a hopeful note on that. What do you see coming?
Well, certainly, you know, even school models, just to throw out one example, the basis charter schools are absolutely world-class. And they do have kids in rows and they still use whiteboards and that sort of thing. So the traditional model can be successful. But we have such amazing technological tools at our fingertips. And for example, the ability to have the best teachers in the world teaching not 20 or 30 students at a time, but thousands of students at a time. And coming in with teaching assistants or tutors to work with kids on an individualized basis. We have computer technology that allows us to measure progress on an ongoing basis to identify when a child needs help in a particular subject. You know, all of these things are so simple and so obvious, and many of them far less costly than the model that we're using right now. And yet they are the vast exceptions to how most children in the United States are educated. We have to have a system that facilitates change, facilitates options and change of existing educational institutions, and enable both teachers and parents, families, to access those opportunities.
Your favorite tool, it seems like, in reading the book this weekend for unshackling education is education savings accounts, which you and I both contributed to the creation of the first program here in Arizona. Tell us about that, and why do you think it's you know, sort of the most powerful tool for bringing out improvement in education?
Well, education savings accounts, as you know, Matt, because we went through that battle here in Arizona, were really a matter of necessity. The Arizona Supreme Court, on which I now serve, struck down school vouchers, but said, hey, what about a system where you could use your education money, not just at private schools, but anywhere for any educational service? And so that's basically for any child who is educated with an education savings account, the government puts their share of education funds in an account that they can use for any educational service. They can buy services from public schools, private schools, homeschooling, tutoring, educational therapy for disadvantaged kids, and on, really facilitating 21st century education. Where that model has fallen short is that we believe that public schools also ought to be funded with these accounts. And most importantly, the money should stay in the school and be controlled by the school. One of the most important reforms that we suggest is eliminating the middleman. This is the story of the tech explosion, is getting rid of the middleman, and that has not happened in education. The money starts at the state in most instances, goes through a school district, which in many instances absorbs 50 cents out of every educational dollar, and then it finally flows down to the schools, which are controlled rigidly. We have more bureaucracy in our educational system than Russia does. That is absolutely awful. And that's one of the reasons why our education system is not nearly as good as almost anything else that we do in the United States, is that we have these middlemen who not only siphon off so much of the money, but also impose rigid controls. So we would go that giant step further and have schools receiving their money, not directly from the government, but through the students, and then the schools themselves can decide who to hire and fire, what their educational priorities are going to be, and really deliver high quality educational services to their kids.
Yeah, just a few minutes before we started recording this, I got an email that said that EdChoice had released a new poll and found that 81% of their respondents favored ESAs. What you're describing in the book is also, although what you just said is a very radical step, right? The idea that money should flow to parents before it goes to a school, right?
That's right.
That by itself would, even, you know, schooling would become very much a voluntary association sort of process. But you're also talking about a system of education that is, I mean, this is a not just school choice, right? This is moving beyond that to sort of education choice, right? Because parents would be empowered to purchase educational services from vendors who are not schools per se, right? At least not schools in the way we typically think about them. Do you think that system is especially kind of like well-suited to the current you know, sort of COVID-19 educational environment.
Now, on the bench, we would call that a softball question.
Is that the objection, the leading, what is it called? Something like that?
No, so long as it's the judge asking the question, which in this case is you, it's perfectly appropriate. But, you know, we wrote this book, we finished it in the beginning stages of the COVID pandemic. If we were writing it now, there'd be even more ideas in there because what we've seen is a catastrophic failure of many public schools to deliver educational services in any way other than the traditional way that they've that they're accustomed to. We've seen families, when they have the means to do so, fending for themselves and discovering a myriad educational opportunities out there, whether it's the Khan Academy, which my kids use to supplement their education. I don't even steer that. They do it themselves. This is purely online, and it's free, completely free. The Learning Pods, our book was finished before this phenomenon came together. As I was saying before, delivering high quality teachers directly to the students and making learning an electrifying, very personalized experience. We have the ability to deliver a highly personalized, high quality educational opportunity to every child in the country today at a fraction of the cost that we're spending on education. But we are so far from that. And I'm hoping that the pandemic will have the same sort of effect, silver lining, here across the country as Hurricane Katrina did in New Orleans, which was to basically say, shoot, our system is falling apart and we need to pursue out-of-the-box thinking right now.
You and Kate have a whole chapter in your book about teachers. Last year, I was listening to a radio program here in Phoenix, talk radio, and a man who identified himself as having been a 44-year veteran of classroom teaching in Arizona offered the following opinion. He said, quote, "The problem with education is not money, because the money has always been tough. The problem with education is that we've strangled the joy out of the profession."
Mm.
In light of that, right, and I really just my jaw dropped when I heard him say that, because it had the loud ring of truth to it, right? How do you think, you know, in this, you know, sort of in a better system and a system that operated more, as you line out in the book, what's in it for teachers, right? What kind of benefits might they see?
Well, the best teachers will see stratospheric opportunities for innovation and for remuneration. The worst teachers will see the door. And one of the things that's been so frustrating, so many people are convinced that we need to add money to the system. But when we do that, and when it results, which it often does not, in increases for teacher salaries, that means the very best teacher in the system gets, say, a 20% increase, and the very worst teacher in the system gets a 20% increase. We need to reward school teachers. And one way to do that, and this is an idea that we borrowed from you, Matt, is to allow the very best teachers to teach far more students, whether it's through remotely or having larger physical classes, and pay them more because they're so superb. Right now, there have been polls that I know you're aware of that show that a vast percentage of teachers would not enter the profession again if they had it to do over again. We can't afford to have burnouts in our classrooms waiting to collect massive pensions. So we suggest several things in the book, and they all kind of pull together. But First of all, obviously allowing performance-based salaries, eliminating pensions and putting that money into teachers' salaries so that they can have transportable accounts. Right now, we are spending a huge portion of our money on people who no longer are part of this system, and we can't keep doing that. We're robbing our future when we do that. Having educational structures that are decentralized, as I was describing, where the money is goes to the school and stays there, and the school's board, along with teachers and principals, can decide how that money is going to be spent. I remember one time when I was in all of all places, the American Marianas Islands, that were considering a school choice program. And I asked a school teacher what she thought of school vouchers. And she said, "Oh, I absolutely hate them. They would destroy public education." And I said, "What about a system where the money would come through the students into the school and you and your colleagues would be able to decide how to spend it?" And her eyes lit up and she said, "We could get new playground equipment." And it's so interesting that you put a different word on something and you know, the reaction is very different. But the point is that the control over funding is far more important than the amount of funding. And we aim to push control away from the bureaucrats and toward the people who have the greatest stake in academic success. And that's principals, teachers, and families. All of our proposals push in that direction.